This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 14th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, protesters across the country battle to stay on Occupy locations as police move in, but one encampment is celebrating. As U.S.-Iran tension rises, we'll look at the charges behind the alleged assassination plot. And in Kashmir, new action on a 15-year-old murder case opens a window into disappearances and police corruption. Those stories and more. First, this news.
I'm Alice Holstein with headlines for FSRN. Fighting broke out in Tripoli today between supporters of Muammar Gaddafi and members of the National Transitional Council, or NTC. It's the first serious gun battle in nearly 2 months and sent at least 9 people to the hospital, according to the BBC. Meanwhile, Amnesty International is calling on the NTC to end the arbitrary detentions and widespread abuse of detainees they say threatens their credibility. Thousands marched across Syria Friday in support of soldiers who have defected from the country's military to the recently formed Syrian Free Army. This follows clashes between the military and its defectors Thursday that the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says left soldiers and civilians dead. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, released a written statement Friday condemning the indiscriminate use of force against peaceful protesters and the shelling of residential neighborhoods in Syria. Her office says the death toll now tops 3,000, including at least 187 children. The U.S. will send around 100 troops to Uganda, President Obama announced in a letter to Congress today. Some already deployed on Wednesday, and the rest will follow later this month. The combat-equipped forces will advise Ugandan soldiers in fighting the Lord's Resistance Army, but won't engage in any combat themselves, except in self-defense. Dozens of people stood on the steps of the state courthouse in New Haven, Connecticut this morning to celebrate an important victory in their fight against police brutality. But other speakers made it clear just how far the community has to go. Melinda Tuhus reports.
No justice!
No peace!
No racist!
Police!
Without admitting fault, the city of New Haven just awarded Abel Sanchez $50,000 in a settlement for the beating he received from Officer Dennis O'Connell several years ago. O'Connell has been the subject of 9 complaints of brutality in the past 6 years, but has been cleared in every case by an internal affairs investigation. Sanchez said the money doesn't make up for his suffering and called for O'Connell to be fired. The settlement is an important step for the African Americans and Latinos who say they've been targeted by rogue members of the New Haven Police Department. The lawyer for Sanchez is filing another brutality case against O'Connell today on behalf of another Latino man who says he was beaten by the officer. Community activist J.O. Richardson said he was shot in the chest by a New Haven cop while sitting in his car with his hands in the air. He's been charged with assault on a police officer and was due in court today.
This is an epidemic. I know countless people that have been victimized by the police.
Today's rally also honored those killed by police officers. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
A federal appeals court issued a ruling today that blocks parts of Alabama's new immigration law, including a provision that public schools check the citizenship of their students, and another that makes it a crime for immigrants to be without proper documentation. However, police will still be able to detain individuals they suspect are in the country illegally. A final ruling on the constitutionality of the law is still many months away. Inmates at California's Pelican Bay Prison temporarily stopped their hunger strike today as their lawyers went into renewed negotiations with the State Department of Corrections. The prisoners are protesting a policy of prolonged solitary confinement, among other conditions they deem inhumane. They first began the hunger strike in July and resumed it in late September when the promised reforms failed to materialize. Demonstrators in San Francisco continue their weeks-long encampment in the city's financial district to protest home foreclosures, bank bailouts, and general inequality. Like other occupations around the country, participants have a need for electricity, and the San Francisco group has found a sustainable way to keep their operation going. Susan Gallimore reports.
At the Occupy San Francisco encampment on Market Street, demonstrators take turns pedaling a stationary bicycle. San Francisco native James Cox Garrity explains the technology behind People Pedal Power.
So what we have essentially is a bike donated from Rock the Bike. It stands about 6 inches from the ground and there's a little motor behind it. So when the wheel spins, the motor spins. We have it directly connected to a battery. Right now it's really basic, but it's definitely getting there, and we have people coming down who really want to help build the system.
Since the group has no backup generator, when one people power peddler finishes cycling, a call goes up through the crowd for someone else to take over.
We literally have somebody on the bike almost 24/7. It's quite an intense system. You know, we go for maybe 5 minutes without it, and then we do a big shout out. I'm done. Who wants to go next?
The activists hope their system will inspire other occupations around the country to consider a similar system of harnessing the power of the people. Susan Gallimore for FSRN San Francisco.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Washington, D.C., I'm Alice Holstein.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. As the Occupy movement continues in cities across the U.S., tension has risen as police and local governments attempt to remove protesters from encampments. Some of the actions have led to arrests. Early this morning in Denver, police in riot gear dismantled tents at the site by the Capitol building, arresting 23 people. In Iowa, the state has denied an extension to a permit for the protest site located on Iowa Capitol grounds, setting up a possible confrontation when the permit expires tonight at 11 p.m. But in Manhattan, Occupy Wall Street is declaring victory after New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg backed down on his pledge to clear protesters from Zuccotti Park. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr was at the park and brings us the story.
Thousands at the month-long encampment in Lower Manhattan erupted into applause as word spread that Mayor Michael Bloomberg called off his promise to evict the protesters. Owners of the public-private Zuccotti Park had issued a 7 a.m. deadline for protesters to leave, ostensibly to clean up unsanitary conditions. But Occupy Wall Street participants resisted. They organized their own park cleanup and called on supporters for help. Among them was New York City Councilwoman Letitia James. She says this moment marks defeat for the mayor's administration.
When we are united, we can never be defeated. And that is the message here today. This is a teaching moment to our society that ideals that we believe in, which are embedded and shredded in our Constitution, cannot be defeated. And so to the mayor of the city of New York, obviously you don't have enough spray and enough jails to house all of these individuals who came out here today. And we stood up today, and we stood up against those forces who would like to silence the First Amendment and silence a growing movement.
Thursday night, cleaning crews doubled their efforts to sweep and mop the park, where thousands have congregated on a daily basis, to meet, share meals, and take part in the participatory decision-making body, the General Assembly. 21-year-old Niral Shah says he came to defend Occupy Wall Street because he supports a space to challenge corporate domination of the political and economic system.
You know, there's obviously a lot of anger about Wall Street specifically, but there's a much bigger and longer trend of a narrative about full faith in markets substituting for the public interest, ignoring the fact that people can't afford educations, that student loan debt isn't dischargeable, that our income tax system has gotten less and less progressive, that people can't afford health insurance, that people can't even afford housing.
The mayor's office and park owner, Brookfield Financial, were flooded by calls, including from local lawmakers demanding a halt to the eviction. Unions, including the UAW and AFL-CIO, came out in support of the protesters. The progressive group Move On said it delivered a petition with 340,000 signatures opposing the eviction. Tenants' rights organizer Esther Wang credits this victory to the movement's broadening base of support.
That's right. I think, you know, as time has gone on, people have realized that those who really have been most impacted by the economic crisis, really by decades of systemic oppression and inequality, these are the people who actually need to be involved in the protests. And I think everybody's understanding that. Unions, community organizations, ordinary residents who aren't maybe affiliated with any organization, the protesters themselves. And it's really beautiful and I think positive to really see this movement becoming, you know, more multi-generational, more multiracial.
According to police, 8 to 10 protesters were arrested later in the morning as celebrating campers attempted to march onto Wall Street itself. Organizer Yotam Merom says he expects an even greater turnout at Saturday's global October 15th mobilization.
Action, there are going to be people having protests and bank sit-ins and all sorts of different actions all over the world and all over the country and over 500 cities. There are going to be online actions. There are going to be creative, artistic actions all over the city. People are going to be struggling over housing and education and jobs and the war and the environment all over the city, all throughout the day, doing a lot of different kinds of creative actions, all culminating at Times Square at 5 p.m. for a sort of like massive show of force.
The mayor insists the eviction at Zuccotti Park has only been postponed and could happen any day. But the protesters say they will continue to be ready to block any such action and vow to remain in the park through the winter months. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
In Washington today, House Democrats urged Republican leaders to take up legislation aimed at pressuring China on its undervalued currency. Complementary legislation passed in the Senate Tuesday on a bipartisan vote, but House Speaker John Boehner said the bill could sour relations with China. Democrats and some economists say the legislation is essential for job creation. FSRN's Michael Lawson reports.
The Senate legislation, which passed 65-35, would pressure China and other countries to allow their currencies to rise, increasing competition for U.S. goods. The bill would alter the way the U.S. Treasury assesses countries that keep their currencies at low rates, making action against China more likely. It would also require tariffs on certain goods from countries with currencies found to be misaligned. House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer at a Capitol press conference Friday.
It is estimated that currency manipulation cost our economy over 1 million jobs. And taking steps to address that problem, which this legislation will do, is a key component of the Make It in America agenda.
House Republican leaders say they will not bring the bill to the floor. Majority Leader Eric Cantor says the Obama administration should state its position on the policies first. The administration has been reluctant to endorse the legislation, saying it could interfere with sensitive trade talks. House Speaker John Boehner called the legislation, quote, dangerous, and questions its impact.
This is well beyond, I think, what the Congress ought to be doing. And while I've got concerns about how the Chinese have dealt with their currency, I'm not sure this is the way to fix it.
A similar bill passed the House in 2010 with the support of 99 Republicans, but did not make it to the Senate. China's currency is estimated to be undervalued by between 5 and 27% against the dollar, according to the International Monetary Fund. The effect is cheaper prices for goods China produces and higher prices for exports from other countries, including the United States. Robert Scott with the Economic Policy Institute has written that correcting misaligned currencies of China and other Asian nations could produce over 2 million jobs in the United States in the next 18 to 24 months by making American exports cheaper across the world. He says globalization has complicated the case for tough action on China.
The problem is that too many American companies have now moved to China and are benefiting from those subsidies. And they're also afraid of offending the Chinese. So we need the national government to stand up and defend our national interest in producing goods here.
Those skeptical of the legislation say it could start a trade war, where China imposes tariffs as well, making goods more expensive for American consumers. Scott says a tenuous economic situation in China makes this less likely. He says currency correction could benefit both countries.
They need desperately to reduce inflation, and if they revalue their currency, it will lower the cost of oil and food and other key commodities that will reduce inflationary pressure in China, which is particularly hurting poor workers that are very dependent on those commodities.
The Chinese accused the U.S. of manipulating its currency through Federal Reserve purchases of U.S. treasuries called quantitative easing. Chinese officials have warned that the legislation could damage relations between the two countries and actually hurt American jobs. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
On Thursday, President Obama pledged to continue tough sanctions against Iran after American officials released details of what they say outlined a plot by two men, including an Iranian-American, to assassinate the Saudi Arabian ambassador. The Iranian government has denied involvement in the charges. But questions have arisen over details of the alleged plot. Today, we take a look at the 20-page legal document outlining the charges. It's an amended criminal complaint filed before the Southern District of New York on October 11th and signed by a special agent of the FBI. Independent journalist Gareth Porter has reported on the document, and he joins us now. Gareth Porter, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Mansour Arbabsiar, the Iranian-American from Texas, first met with a DEA informant. Now, you've suggested that that meeting seems to center on what was essentially a potential drug deal. How did that get to the alleged plot to assassinate the Saudi Arabian ambassador?
Well, this, of course, is the big mystery surrounding this whole case. And I have suggested in my story that it seems most likely that indeed Arbabsiar approached the DEA informant, thinking, of course, he was part of the Mexican drug cartel, in the belief that he could make a drug deal with a Mexican drug cartel on behalf of a group of Iranian officials, apparently with connections with the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and its Quds force. So that makes it clear, I think, that definitely what the primary interest of Arbabsiar was doing a drug deal. Now, how did that turn into a terrorist plot? I think the answer is that the DEA informant, led him on. We have reason to believe this because during those 2 weeks, there's not a single quote from the from Arbabsiar about anything having to do with an assassination plot, or even for that matter, a terrorist action against Saudi Arabia or the Saudi Arabian embassy or anything like that. There's absolutely nothing that they've been able to come up with during those from those meetings and during those 2 weeks, and that suggests that in fact they did not have anything from Arbabsiar that they could use. And by the way, we know that those meetings must have been recorded because if there was either a drug case or a terrorist case, there would be reason to be recording those meetings. And therefore, I think it's reasonable to assume that what was happening was that they were trying to get Arbabsiar on board to talk about a terrorist action against the Saudi Arabian ambassador and to implicate people back in Tehran. And they were not able to do that during those 2 weeks.
Well, one of the meetings that's outlined in this complaint and also a subject of your article is the July 17th meeting, and that's when the attack on the restaurant and the Saudi diplomat first comes up. What are the details of that meeting?
Well, first of all, we have to mention that there was another meeting on July 14th, which the FBI says they did record. And this is the meeting in which there are a series of quotes, direct quotes from the DEA informant saying things like, "I'm going to go ahead and do the hit on the Saudi ambassador or do the Saudi Arabia," as he put it, I believe.
And that's the DEA. That's the DEA informant. That's
the
not
DEA informant saying this. And it was as if he was hoping to get a response from the from Arbabsiar that they could use to implicate Iran in some way. And apparently they got nothing because the only quote that is carried in the FBI report from Arbabsiar at the July 14th meeting was a single word. The word ambassador.
Now, after Arbabsiar's arrest, he called his cousin in Iran, and intelligence agents recorded it. What do you make of that evidence?
Well, of course, this indicates very clearly that he was already part of the sting operation. Within days of his arrest on September 29th, he was, as you suggest, making calls to Shukari with the explicit purpose of helping the FBI entrap him, basically, to get him to say things that would implicate him more directly in the plot.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for today, but lots of questions on this alleged assassination plot. Investigative journalist Gareth Porter is an expert on U.S. policy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can find a link to Gareth Porter's article on our website, fsrn.org. As Iraqis prepare to travel to Mecca for the annual pilgrimage, a small village on the road to Saudi Arabia has become a major source of tension. The town is contested by rival provinces, and the area has been the scene of violence in recent years. David Enders reports from Naheb in western Iraq.
As sectarian violence has ebbed in Iraq, Naheb has remained a flashpoint. It lies on the border of Anbar province, which is largely Sunni Muslim, and Karbala province, which is largely Shia. Both provinces claim control of the town, which is also a waypoint to Shiite shrines in Syria. Members of the Iraqi government from Karbala say Naheb was placed under control of Anbar by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in 1977 in order to prevent Shiite opposition groups from having easy access to Iraq's borders. Last month, 22 Shiite pilgrims were killed near Naheb as they traveled back to Iraq from Syria. A similar attack in 2009 left 25 dead. Shiite lawmakers blame both attacks on Sunni extremists and accuse Anbar's police of being unwilling to protect Shia. Fuad al-Dorki is a member of the Iraqi parliament from Karbala.
The members of the parliament from Karbala governorate are asking the central government to use national security forces to protect the pilgrims who use this road.
In response to last month's attacks, security forces from Karbala entered Anbar in order to apprehend suspects, but no arrests were made. On Friday, hundreds of sheikhs from Anbar province met in Naheb with members of Iraq's central government to pray and reaffirm the town's status as a part of Anbar. They also discussed the ability of Anbar's security forces to control the area. Among those in attendance was Afan al-Asawi, a member of parliament from Anbar.
It's part of Al-Anbar, no doubt with this issue. There's some people, they try to make trouble, they try to make space between us and between Karbala. They can't, inshallah. It's our province, it's our land. We able to protect this very important section in Al-Anbar, and we will keep fighting all the groups, the Qaeda or any other groups, they try to attack the Hajj, the Hajjis, the people who use this road.
Naheb is not the only Iraqi city that is disputed, and an article of the Iraqi constitution that was ratified in 2005 provides for referendums to settle which governorates disputed cities belong to, though so far no date has been set for a referendum on Naheb. With support from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, David Enders, FSRN, Naheb, Iraq.
In Indian-administered Kashmir, a 15-year-old triple murder case has resurfaced, underscoring ongoing issues of forced disappearances and corruption. Families of the three murder victims are demanding a new investigation, accusing the police of complicity. FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan has more.
The case begins in 1996 with a late-night knock at the door of Fazal Hussain's house in Badarwa district of Indian-administered Kashmir. Fazal's son Yasir Arafat recalls what happened to him and his elder brother Farid Hussain.
We were sleeping in our room when three armed people wearing police uniforms, faces covered, entered our room. My father, who was sleeping in the other room, had already been taken. And then they took my brother too. My mother followed them outside and saw them being taken away in a police vehicle.
In the following days, the family came to learn that the father and son had been picked up, along with two others, by a government-backed counterinsurgent, Muhammad Ashraf, and his accomplices. The four men were driven in a police vehicle to an isolated riverbank in the dead of night. They were blindfolded, shot, and thrown into the river. Of the four, one man miraculously survived, while the bodies of three others were never found. The accused Ashraf was arrested and tried in a local court. However, the court acquitted him for lack of enough evidence. Kashmiri human rights activist Parvez Imroz says that police had deliberately prepared a weak case that could not stand up in the court.
police filed an FIR and conducted so-called investigation. Filed a case in the court, and the case was weak, which was even structures were passed against the police by the judge, resulted into the acquittal.
In its judgment, the trial court said the prosecution's evidence was weak and failed to establish the guilt of the accused beyond doubt. It now surfaces that a parallel investigation had been taken up by the crime branch of the police on the direction of India's National Human Rights Commission, but the findings of this investigation were never produced in the court.
The same year, 1996, we had pleaded with the National Human Rights Commission for help, as we thought nothing was coming out of police investigations. However, we had no idea that they had directed any investigation. We were never told anything.
Although the families didn't know it at the time, the crime branch investigation indicted a senior police officer for having provided the logistics, like police vehicle and weapons, to the main accused Ashraf. The official, Kuldeep Khoda, is currently the topmost police official or Director General of Police for Indian Administered Kashmir. The case re-emerged last month after a New Delhi-based newspaper reported the findings of the shelved crime branch report. Encouraged by the new information, the families went to the High Court seeking a re-investigation. Activist Imrose, who is also a lawyer, is pleading the case for families in the High Court.
Important is that how the top officials were part and parcel of the operation, and the non-state actors were working under their instructions, as has been happening in this case. So the involvement of the top officials, meaning that we are saying it was not an aberration, it is a pattern, it was a matter of policy of the state.
New Delhi-based Supreme Court lawyer and activist Prashant Bhushan is also appearing on behalf of the victims in the case. Bhushan says the case is important in light of the recent state acknowledgement of thousands of unmarked graves in the region.
Therefore, this is one case which can be reinvestigated properly by an independent investigating agency, and where the perpetrators of this crime can be brought to book.
Activist Imrose says the reinvestigation will send a message to high-ranking police officials involved in such crimes that they are not above the law. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Alice Olstein. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Jane Chang and Shauna Ray. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.